Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Johnson, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. Calling case A21-0895, Elmer Puce versus City of Burnsville.
I was having a hard time unmuting, sorry. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. You each will have 15 minutes for your arguments. Please state your name at the beginning of your arguments because this will be posted on our website, or I guess our website. Mr. Cooper, you'll have 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it. If at any time there are technical difficulties, please let us know because we want to make sure that we hear you and that you hear us, and we want to give you the time that's allotted. So with that, Mr. Cooper, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honors, and thank you very much. This case is basically about the conversion of a very clear and limited right to reimbursement of costs that arise by granting a subdivision into a general assessment for all public lands unrelated to the granting of that subdivision. The standard of review is de novo for two reasons. One, there were no witnesses, and as this court has said, or as the Supreme Court said previously, when there's no witnesses, the appellate court is as capable of evaluating the evidence as is the trial court. Additionally, this is all legal issues. There aren't really factual issues here. This is really a legal debate. And that's why it was done by stipulated evidence. There were no witnesses. There was no testimony, and there was no credibility determinations. What we start off here with is the state granted, consistent with constitutional restrictions, a series of statutes that governed what a city could or could not charge as a park dedication fee. And very simply put, it had several requirements. The first requirement was, in order to have a fee at all, the subdivision had to have created some new need for the city that the city would not otherwise have had. As we'll talk about in a minute, that never happened here. Second, if the city does believe that there is some sort of cost that is attendant to granting the subdivision, it must do an analysis of how much that roughly is. It doesn't have to be precise, but it has to do an analysis that says, because you did this, we're going to need that. It did that in terms of its residential ones, but it did not do it in terms of its industrial commercial ones. And the residential, it's how many units will there be, how many people are per unit, what is the national average of parks that are needed for that. But in the industrial commercial, it just said 5%. Now and it was said, both admitted by the opposing side in their brief and said in the hearing that took place before City Council, that's automatic to every single property. It always is applied. Most everything else we'll be talking about is really irrelevant because this happened because of the application of that automatic fee, 5% always. Of course, that's tremendously unfair to people who are not creating any new park needs. But beyond that, it has no basis. What is very important is in the record, as you look at the record, there's absolutely nowhere in there where it says, where did the 5% come from? Although the city admits the amount of parks created by commercial industrial properties is much lower and much different than that for residential. It never says what that percentage is. It just says it's different. In this case, my client wound up spending a lot more than he would have if it had been treated as residential. If it had been treated as residential, it would have been zero. And the reason it would have been zero is this is a one lot subdivision. It's really questionable to me whether you can call it a subdivision, but the city insisted on calling it a subdivision. We had one lot, and that one lot was not compliant with the zoning laws. And so it was brought into compliance. And when it was brought into compliance, they required this fee. Now, initially, they said the fee was $37,000. And they did that by completely ignoring the state statute. They did not do an individualized assessment at all of what this particular property was worth. They just applied 5% to what the average value is in the entire for this zoning area. in the entire city. We challenged that and pointed out what the statute says, and they had to comply with the statute. The statute says the fair market value of this particular property is determined by its taxes and any other relevant data. So they corrected it and brought it down to $11,000. But the reason that's instructive, it shows how easy, if somebody doesn't have a friend who's an attorney, for somebody to wind up with a situation where they pay way more than it's worth, and don't have any ability to do anything about it. And that's because they ignored the statute. Then we go to the next part of the statute, and one of the key, two of the key things here, they went all the way across the statute, and there's no part of it that was complied with. And let's go to the things they're supposed to do. First, they're supposed to establish that this subdivision caused the need for the money. That's why their ordinance is unconstitutional. There is no provision in their ordinance that allows for any consideration whatsoever of whether the subdivision did or did not cause the need for new parks. That's completely out of there. And it shall. It shall be 5%. It's not it may be 5%. It's not that you must look at it and consider it. It's mandatory. And as the mayor said at the hearing, they always, not sometimes, they always charge 5%.
Mr. Cooper?
Well, yes.
Before you go further, I'd like to understand. You've argued, I think, alternative theories. You've argued that the ordinance is on its face contrary to the state statute. And I think you've also argued that in the application, the city violated the statute.
Correct.
And I guess I'm wondering from your point of view, your client's point of view, would it matter? I mean, how are those two theories different in their ultimate consequences?
Your Honor, they are not. The ultimate consequences are identical. It just points out that the state statutes were put together to bring us into compliance with the Supreme Court decisions Dolan and Nolan, which set out what you have to do. But the state statute is perfect. There's nothing wrong with the state statute. The state statute takes the U.S. Supreme Court decisions, creates the rules that are consistent with that, implies it. But in terms of what you're saying, in terms of what you're asking, is the outcome here any different whether we just apply the state statute or whether we apply the constitutional considerations? No, it's not.
And I guess that was my next question, actually, whether you are prefer relief under the statute or the Constitution. But my original question, I guess, had to do with the distinction between a facial challenge and an as-applied challenge.
Let me address that then.
Yeah.
I think I misunderstood your question. The facial challenge is different in this respect. The facial challenge is even if the city had complied with what the constitutional requirements are pursuant to an unconstitutional statute, that would still mean they would lose. However, in this particular case, they didn't comply with what the statute would say because they never did the four or five things that are required. But it is different in that respect. And I apologize for not understanding your question.
No, that's okay. I mean, are you seeking something in the nature of like a declaration? I'm wondering if that is necessary for your client to be made whole. And if that's an additional remedy that you're seeking from the court, and if so, if it's essential to your appeal, or if it's sufficient for your client's position to simply grant him relief with respect to the fee that he was required to pay.
Your Honor, I think it would be appropriate to, and I think we asked to strike the ordinance down as written. That is an additional remedy, but an answer to your very much more specific question, is that required by my client's request? No, it's not, but it certainly would prevent him from the same ordinance then being reused against him again. I'm trying to say this in a way that's correctly answering your question. My client could receive relief without addressing the constitutionality of the ordinance, but it makes more sense in that it's in front of you and this ordinance is ongoing and it's applied to every single person ongoingly in Burnsville, including my client prospectively, that it would make more sense to require Burnsville to rewrite their ordinance consistent with the statute. So I guess that's the best I can do in answering that. And I guess to a significant degree, I am concerned that if the ordinance is not struck down, not only will other people, but also my client have to face it again, because he's still, this business has never been created as a result of this legal dispute. The property is just sitting there. My concern is if there's not clear ruling out of this court, we're not confident that we will wind up with this matter fully resolved.
So, Mr. Cooper, if I may.
Yes.
Judge Johnson was headed down the direction my questions are going, so I can be brief. I mean, because you have a lot of different legal theories here, but if we have concerns about, if the panel has concerns about whether or not the ordinance complied with the statute, you know, why wouldn't we just rule on that basis and not, why would we need to reach, you know, constitutional issues or anything else? Why isn't it just a, you know, from your perspective, a, does the ordinance, which says shall be based on this standard, comply with the individual determinations required by the statute?
Your Honor, if I understand your question, I think what you're saying, if you were to just strike down this case, I'm not sure which way you said it, whether you were to strike down the ordinance or whether you were to strike down this case, would that address my client's situation? And my answer to that is pretty much, not 100%, but pretty much either way, if you struck down the ordinance, then that would totally deal with my client's situation and you would need not to go any further. That would be the end of it. And that would be 100% cure.
But if wouldn't need to go to the constitutional issues. That would just be as a matter of compliance with the state statute, correct? And I'm not saying the panel's yes. going to do that. I just want to understand.
No, I understand.
How
I understand.
We need to address.
I guess, and I apologize because I am thinking a little bit off the top of my head, and that always scares me. But as far as your question is concerned, I think it would, yes.
Mr. Cooper, then that begs the question, again, in your view, are you asking us to strike the entire ordinance or just certain paragraphs or sentences of it? I mean, are there certain parts of the ordinance that may be preserved? In other words, are you taking a laser approach to that or more of a general approach to the entire ordinance?
The entire ordinance that has to do with the issue of granting subdivisions subject to a park dedication fee would all need to be struck. I've gone through some of them in our oral argument here, but that does not affect any other parts of the ordinance which do not specifically have to do with park dedication fees. Every aspect of the park dedication fee is inconsistent with state statute and inconsistent with constitutional law. I talked a little bit in my briefing about the fact the way they keep the money is inconsistent with the statute, the way they spend the money is inconsistent with the statute. Virtually every part, the way what they say they can spend it on, any public lands they say they can spend it on, they don't comply in any aspect of this part, and that is to say the park dedication fee. So I think it would all have to be struck down. So I don't think this is a laser issue, because what they did here is they created an ordinance which allows them to take money from from subdivisions and spend it somewhere else. So I'm opening a subdivision, they say I need more parks, and then they spend it at the city parking lot or the city swimming pool. They do not spend it for anything that has to do with my subdivision. So from top to bottom, from how they collect the money, why they collect the money, and don't forget, there is no correlation whatsoever between the amount of money I'm charged and the amount of cost I created. It's a flat 5%. And there's no assessment of whether I even created any. It's a flat 5%. And then that money goes into a general capital fund. And there's no keeping track of where that money goes. There's nothing that says, and in fact, we know it's not. It's not being spent back on the subdivisions it came from. And when you look at the city's long-range plans, they're upset that they don't have more land to develop because they won't be able to have this fudge money to throw into the capital fund that they can spend on their park system. So I'm not seeing any part of their ordinance which is compliant. Don't forget, the ordinance isn't very long. It's like a page. It's not like we're talking the state statute, which goes on for many pages and has many considerations. But I would say, and I think I've answered your question. Going on to the other points here, Your Honor, is The one argument they come up with to justify what they did is to say, well, we're trying to put these two, connect these trails. The problem with that is multiple. First of all, there is nothing in the record that says that has anything to do with my client's property, nor does common sense indicate it has anything to do with my client's property. My client's property is a one lot property that may have some cars being sold and repaired there. And it has nothing to do with connecting these trails. And another little slippage they make is they sometimes try to argue if you use a park, that's the same thing as creating a park. No, it's not. The statute is clear. It's not if somebody's going to use a park, that does not mean you created the need for the park. What has to happen is there has to be, oops, I see my time's almost up. Let me, if there's any other questions, I'll answer them quickly. Otherwise, I'll just conclude. Okay.
Judge Johnson, I see you're unmuted. Do you have a question?
I do not.
Thank you.
Okay, well, just in conclusion, this has just been a total diversion of a particular purpose for reimbursement and converting it to a money collecting scheme, which is exactly what our Supreme Court in Collis said would constitute grand theft. And the Supreme Court, the U.S., said the same thing, not the same words, but the same thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel Paul Reavers on behalf of respondent City of Burnsville. We ask the court to affirm the district court's decision following a court trial on this matter. And I want to address out of the chute the standard of review. Excuse me. It's a clearly erroneous standard. And I want to note that my colleague, the 1976 case, In Re Trust, known as Great Northern Iron Ore Properties, was reversed or overruled by the 1985 amendment to Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 5201. 5201 states, findings of fact, whether based on oral or documentary evidence, shall not be set aside unless clearly erroneous. And again, with all due regard given to the opportunity of the trial court to judge the credibility of the witnesses, this $11,700 park dedication fee, we work to streamline this for the court. That does not change the standard of review. The district court was the fact finder. The district court did connect the dots, and those findings are supported by the record and are not clearly erroneous on this record. The second point I want to make, counsel has attacked, is alleging a facial challenge to the ordinance. I wanted to cite the court to an additional authority, the McGoutree v. City of Red Wing case, 831 Northwest 2nd, 518, page 522, and that's a Supreme Court decision out of 2013. It was a challenge to the Red Wing rental licensing ordinance. And again, the court said the challenger faces a heavy burden of proving the legislation is unconstitutional in all applications. And so it's an extremely high burden. It means there is no set of circumstances under which the ordinance can be upheld. And here the district court found, and I'll walk the court through the findings, that as applied, the statute, the ordinance was fully constitutional as applied to Mr. Poops. So they cannot establish a facial challenge that under every single circumstance, this law is unconstitutional. And that's
Mr.
consistent.
Reavers? Didn't mean to interrupt, but I thought you were done with your kind of opening.
Sure.
Looking at paragraph E of subdivision 2B of the statute, that's the paragraph, single sentence that says the municipality must reasonably determine and so on. Where do we look to find that determination by the city? Am I correct? There's no resolution that was adopted by the city council. I've seen a 6-page findings of fact document that I think makes no mention of this determination. So if we want to see the city's determination required by paragraph E, where do we find it?
It's actually in the transcript and it's a discussion. So I think where the court starts with in the January 22nd transcript, you know, the issue is raised, the city council directs staff to review the issue. And you know, I'll provide the court with a number of sites here, but just as we talk about subdivision E, you know, the suggestion that this is just a blind application, you know, the last sentence of subdivision E that indicates when the city takes cash, they use the average cost per acre in the zoning district established. So they use here, that's why the numbers started high.
Okay, Mr. Reavers, I think maybe you misunderstood my question. I apologize. I'm looking at a state statute that has a paragraph E.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at, I see what you're saying.
I apologize. So I'm looking at the section 462.358 mm-hmm. subdivision 2B without any parens. And then paragraph E says the municipality must reasonably determine that it will need to acquire that portion of land for the purposes stated in this subdivision as a result of approval of the subdivision. So if I want to find the city's determination required by that paragraph, where do I find it?
In the transcript of the March, the discussion, the evidence supporting the finding, again, the district court made the finding that, and I guess I point the court to a number of citations in the transcript of the March 5th, 2019 City Council meeting.
Okay.
And I will point the court to, I'll give you a few pages here and I'll talk why they're important. Pages 22, 23, 24, 29, I guess pages 22 through 31 is, and then also, yes, those are the pages that I think are the important discussion of this. And then also the staff report, which the March 5th, 2019 staff report discussing that, that staff met to discuss this. So the city attorney really summarized, because what happened was, after the issue was raised at the first meeting, staff met, city attorney, city engineer, city planner, that's in the record. And that's the discussion here. And that's the explanation. And even the city attorney explains, and this is on page 24 of the transcript, that initially it was based on the average commercial value of land. And that's the city's ordinance. And then it goes on to say, they took a particularized look at this parcel, because if you look at the city's ordinance compared to that, so they connected it, and I'll say, where's the other part?
So does the staff report, which I do not have in front of me, does it quantify in some way the amount of use of a park trail or any other park, city park, arising from the new subdivision, the proposed use of the subdivision?
I think the explanation is more in the transcript, Your Honor. I think the staff report summarizes that staff met and the explanation of why they got there.
So in the transcript, I mean, it seems to me that I noticed on page 25, I think, of the transcript, Member Schultz asks, where are we creating a new park or park space? And it seems like the city attorney responds that we don't have anything in the CIP for actual land acquisition. I don't believe we do. And then a couple of pages later, Member Peterson provides some, he makes reference. He seems to be, for the first time, calling the other council members' attention the fact that there's an existing plan to expand the regional trails, and there's a couple segments that are needing a gap to be closed. But after that comment, there's no further reference to the trail the district court found that the council, the city, wanted to close a gap in the trail, and I don't see any mention of it except for that one member's statement on page 27 of the transcript. But to me, that doesn't seem to represent a collective, deliberative decision by the city council.
Well, that's the record that we had in front of the district court, and the district court found that if that was a reasonable determination, that it really, as the city attorney explained,
where do we have, there's five council members, right? I mean, what document embodies the decision, the agreement of all five, or at least a majority of the five council members to impose the fee for that particular purpose?
Well, again, I can only point the court to the transcript and the discussion of it leading to the decision. And ultimately, that staff's recommendation was to require that. And again, I'll read the conclusion from the city attorney. In my opinion, the subject, this is on page 30 and 31 of the transcript. And this amount, in my opinion, is subject to argument, whether it's defensible and reasonable. But like I said, I think we're in the ballpark, certainly more than we were previously based on the adjustments that were made. And my recommendation is to require the payment of the $11,700 that is consistent with our park dedication formulas. And again, this is a staff recommendation. So where's the evidence in the record? You've got the city engineer, city planner, and city attorney meeting, and again, providing the city council with the basis to adopt that fee. Is that in the resolution? I can't point that to the court, but I can point you to the actual transcript where it was discussed in front of the city council, and the district court had that evidence. I mean, this is, the district court was able to make findings to look at that and determine that the city's basis that this particular subdivision would create a need, that has a reasonable basis. That's a factual determination by the district court that is entitled to deference by this court.
Did you just make reference to a resolution? Is there a resolution? I haven't seen.
I think it's just the motion to approve. I guess I can't point the court to that, Your Honor. I'm just saying that I think we're relying on the actual transcript and discussion. And again, the idea is that the underlying premise is, listen, development is going to create a need for parks. And the district court agreed with that underlying premise. And that's the basis of judicial review.
How many people are either going to be working at the site or visiting the site as a result of the proposed use? Does the city know that?
We don't have a precise number. I think what I pointed the court in our brief is, and it's in the city council packet, the March 5th, 2019 city packet. I think just looking at the site plan, look at the intensity of use here. And I want to dispel this notion too, that wait a minute, this is not a one lot subdivision. In 2020, this was subdivided and the city deferred park dedication or all platting fees on this parcel. So this is not a one, you know, the city deferred it. They don't do that anymore, but they did it. But I think the intensity of the use, you know, we go from a residential house to a bakery. I hold it up. You know, the whole looking at the intensity, their goal is to bring people, any business is, they want people to come. And the district court made a finding, you know, that it was a reasonable basis. And again, I point the court to the findings 7 and 8, and also conclusion number 4, you know, that due to the existing nearby park and nearby trail and parks infrastructure, the city's belief that the property will increase existing park infrastructure appears reasonable. And that connects the dot to that point you raised initially, Your Honor, you know, subdivision E, that there needs to be a connection there. The district court found we did that. And based on this record, that they're going to substantially increase what they're doing on that site, that's a reasonable determination. We'll never be able to have a precise mathematical formula. And the Supreme Court in Collis cautioned against that because that's too heavy a burden of a municipality to connect.
And so as a matter of constitutional law in Dolan, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the city must make some effort to quantify its findings in support of the dedication for a pedestrian bicycle pathway beyond the conclusory statement that it could offset some of the traffic. And that was an issue about, I think, traffic. But and I think that in the Dolan case, there was anyway, but it seems like there's no quantification here.
They didn't do a number. And I think that's where the city attorney explained that we can't, we're in the ballpark. And I think that's where, that's where I pointed the court to the pages that I provided to you. And I think you've already got them, but I think it just, those are the discussion there that we're in the ballpark. This is again, city engineer, city planner, and city attorney together providing that provides a reasonable basis for the city council to make that determination. And we're talking $11,700. Again, they took a particularized view of this because if they applied the ordinance, as written, it would be $37,500. They did look at this in a particular manner, and that's why it was reduced, because his value was not based on the average in the district. So the ordinance is compliant with the statute and incorporates the nexus and proportionality requirements of the statute. And they did look at it. I mean, this is not, if it was just a blank line application, it would have stayed at 37,500. And that's not what happened here. And again, the district court, and if you read the district court's findings too, or the discussion, district court, not a fan of it, but you know, I'll quote, you know, I think under these circumstances, the law and the ordinance were correctly applied and didn't find their way to a level of invalidity, either on a procedural basis or constitutional basis. And this is an addendum, page 28. It's page 10 of the, you know, of the transcript of the proceedings based on the plaintiff's post-trial motion. So again, on this record, and again, this is a court trial. This is not a summary judgment. This is the record must be viewed in a light most favorable to the district court's factual findings. And on this record, we ask, and I guess before I conclude here quickly, the city's park dedication fund is fully compliant with state law. We provided the site to that. The thing I want to make clear is my colleague keeps citing Minnesota statute 462.353. That has application to professional fees, not to here. 462.358 subdivision 2BG. Limit, you know, it has to be in a dedicated fund. It is, and it's allowed for acquisition and improvement. And that's what's happened here. On this record, we ask the court to affirm the district court's factual determination that the city's application of the park dedication fees was lawful and proper in all respects. Thank you.
Judge Raleigh, may I ask one more question?
You certainly may.
Mr. Reavers, to accomplish the goal of closing a gap in the bike trail, does the city need to acquire the property that is in the gap, or is the property already, does the city already have the property rights it needs and simply needs to build it out?
Candidly, Your Honor, I don't know that that's in the record. I'm not sure. I can't point the court to the record evidence of that. But I don't think it. I guess I don't know. I'll just leave it there. I'm not sure.
Anything else from either of my colleagues? Thank you, Mr. Reavers. Mr. Cooper, do you have any rebuttal? You're muted.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, there's a number of things. First of all, much of the argument we just heard is nowhere in his brief. He cites some new cases that he claims are relevant, but the cases that he cited on the constitutional issue in his initial brief were addressed in our brief. And they specifically, that's Advantage, that's a couple other cases. And they specifically say, Advantage and Tanner are specifically cases that say, if you are individually harmed, then the whole ordinance is up for examination. It's only if, and this is a, these are standing cases. It's only if you were not harmed at all, like an environmental case or something like that, you have to show that you had some particular harm to challenge the statute. So whatever case he cited today, and I haven't read it, but I have read the cases he cited in the appropriate time period, and they simply do not say what he says he says. The second thing is these are legal issues that are before the court. And to the degree that which he is claiming there was a factual basis, there simply was not. As Judge Johnson went through with him, there's nowhere in that record is there a factual basis for the two things. One, I didn't even hear him suggest that there was any determination of what amount of money granting this subdivision would have required in new parks. He didn't even address it. Second of all, he doesn't address how this subdivision created the need for those trails. It simply does not. As Judge Johnson pointed out, there's only one reference in the entire record to this trail. And that's that reference that says anybody can use it, including the people going to this location. There's nothing in there in that one site that suggests that there's anything about this particular, and it, I was going to read the quote, but it's in my brief, so I won't try to find it quickly. There's nothing in this record that suggests there's anything about the granting of this particular subdivision. Now, we have the exact sign of exact sort of speculation that, again, Judge Johnson was pointing out. They're speculating that maybe there'll be traffic. No study to show that. And specifically, as you recall, in one of those Supreme Court cases, that was the justification they were using to try to say they could have a trail along the ocean, but they had no specificity to it. There's no basis for it. Most importantly, though, as we wander through all these other arguments, this ordinance requires 5% regardless of anything. And they applied the 5% regardless of anything. Now, he tries to say, oh, we bended from that. No, we didn't. They used 5% on a figure that was non-compliant with state statute. State statute says it's supposed to be used on the property taxes. It's an individualized determination. Every single thing about this ordinance tries to de-specify what you have to do. And even the cases they cite, they'll say, well, we can do general. None of them say that. They all come back to what the Minnesota Supreme Court said and said, nonetheless, you have to do the individual analysis, whether you like it or not, before you can apply this fee. Simply put, we have a fee here that has been totally converted. Remember the history. And he cites in his brief this curious little thing about, oh, you know, people are selling the property. It's a real old case. People are selling the property, and therefore they don't have the same number of protections because you're building a whole bunch of houses and then you're selling them. Here, that's not what's going on. The same guy owned it, still owns it. He's not selling it to anybody. So that emotional argument has no validity. But the law is clear. It's a reimbursement statute. Otherwise, it's unconstitutional. And by the way, I forgot to point out, it's not just the U.S. Constitution. It's also the Minnesota Constitution. It's unconstitutional under both. It's in violation of the statutes, every single one of them. And there's so many he ignores. There's like six we cite, and they didn't comply with any of the six. To the degree that he wants to argue that somehow or other the district court is entitled to a higher standard of protection, doesn't matter, because there's no factual basis for its conclusion. There's no fact in there that says, on that one little paragraph that was read, and that's the only paragraph, there's no fact in there that says, therefore, we need this trail. It merely says, oh, they could use it just like everybody else. There's no fact in there that says, oh, this is what it would cost. And the reason there isn't is because of the defectiveness of this ordinance. They don't care. And we cited and when you look at, he keeps citing to what the city attorney said, the city attorney admitted, we're looking for money to keep our beautiful park system, and I'm paraphrasing, but we're looking for money to keep our beautiful park system intact. That is exactly what you're not permitted to do. And I will stop at this point unless there's any questions.
Judges, colleagues, I don't see any questions. Thank you. This is a really interesting case. It was well briefed and well argued, and we will have our decision out in the 90 days. Thank you very much, gentlemen. That concludes our oral calendar, and we will now go into conference on the cases. Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.